The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Conventional wisdom holds that the presidential primary process weeds out extreme candidates in favor of political moderates who would stand a better chance of winning the general election. That's arguably why Mitt Romney got the nomination in 2012 over folks like Rick Santorum, and one reason Hillary Clinton has an edge over someone like Senator Elizabeth Warren. But political scientist Seth Masket says that any candidate, no matter how far to the left or right they stand, would have just as good a chance of winning the general should they win their party's nomination. Seth Masket is associate professor of political science at the University of Denver. He also writes the What Makes Us Politic column for Pacific Standard. And Seth, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, first, Seth, your article cites Ted Cruz as an example of an extreme candidate. What do you think makes him the extreme?
Well, by far he has one of the most conservative voting records in the U.S. Congress, and that is he just continually votes kind of at the rightmost edge of the Republican Party. He's really staked out very ideologically extreme positions on taxation, on the regulatory role of government. There's even an analysis on 538.com that just sort of looked at different presidential candidates, their public statements, their voting records, their fundraising patterns. And Ted Cruz, in most categories, came out as among the most conservative, if not the most conservative, of any of the recent presidential candidates.
So maybe offer up a Democrat who would also be considered to be extreme.
I suppose probably one of the better examples would be Elizabeth Warren. She is pretty far to the left compared to other Democratic senators, votes very consistently with the party line, and generally advocates for pretty liberal views. So yeah, it's not a perfect analogy, but I suppose, where Ted Cruz is to the Republicans, Elizabeth Warren is to the Democrats.
So let's say Elizabeth Warren wins the nomination. Now, what makes you think that she would be just as electable as a Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden?
Well, I don't know if she would be just as electable, but it wouldn't be far off in the sense that voters actually don't have a great sense of ideological distinctions between candidates. They can definitely perceive them between the parties. So they understand that a Democrat is very different from a Republican. But within the parties, there's actually not much evidence that ideology makes a huge difference. There's probably some. And we can look to some historical examples to see times when more ideologically extreme candidates seem to have suffered somewhat at the polls. I mean, you might look at something like Barry Goldwater running in 1964 or George McGovern running in 1972. Those folks were generally perceived to be pretty far outside the mainstream. They were running against presidents who were seen as pretty moderate, and they probably suffered for it. But that hasn't happened in a while. And that was also at a time when voters were much more fluid in their voting patterns. Like there were like moderate to conservative Democratic voters who generally would stick with the Democratic Party, but would actually abandon their party if they thought their candidate was too extreme. There were more liberal Republican voters who would abandon their party if they thought a candidate was too extreme. You really don't see that as much today.
So if people aren't paying attention to ideology, what are they looking for with candidates?
Well, they largely focus on what they call the political fundamentals, things like, is the economy strong or weak? Are we at war or peace? And generally speaking, if the economy is going pretty well, if we're not losing a lot of soldiers in a foreign war, voters will tend to keep the party that's in power. And if they don't like the way things are going, they'll dump the party that's in power in favor of the other party. But which candidate it is that bears the standard of that party actually doesn't make a huge difference there.
Well, I'm thinking of those elections, you know, McGovern losing to Nixon in 72, Goldwater, who lost to LBJ in 1964. And Nixon, was it Nixon, I believe, who famously said, you know, you campaign from the edge and then you govern from the center. So doesn't this idea that an extremist candidate stands an equal chance of winning as a moderate go against all that we hear about the importance of the independents, the swing voters, who are really moderates at heart?
Well, I mean, you certainly see candidates talking about that, but we actually don't see a lot of evidence of that moderation in the end. There is certainly these things to consider at the primary stage. Okay, so, you know, candidates do recognize that the people who will show up for primaries or caucuses do tend to be more ideologically extreme than, you know, your average November election voter. And they do try to appeal to those people and, you know, to try and appeal to the activists who will turn out and donors who will give money. But you actually don't see, like, we saw Mitt Romney doing that quite a bit, trying to appeal to those folks, you know, recognizing that he certainly had a kind of a moderate reputation. But there wasn't a whole lot of walking back after the primaries. He basically stuck to his guns. And interestingly enough, a lot of surveys showed that voters considered him the more moderate candidate between him and President Obama. That is, they perceived Mitt Romney as ideologically closer to them than they did the president, but they nonetheless preferred the president by a few points.
So are we so ideologically divided as a nation that if somebody makes the primary, it doesn't really necessarily matter how extreme their views are, just that they're a Republican or a Democrat?
To a large extent, yes. Now, it's possible that a party could nominate someone who's just so far outside the mainstream that voters would notice and get truly offended by it. And for the most part, the parties have been very skilled at avoiding those problems. They manage to generally nominate pretty competent people who are roughly within the mainstream of their party and don't stand out as extreme or crazy in any ways. But to a large extent, people will continue to vote with the party they have preferred for many years. You've got, like, you know, 95% of Democrats will vote for the Democratic nominee. 95% of Republicans will vote for the Republican nominee. And the part at which these things matter, which ideological stances matter, comes much earlier, at the primary stage and at the caucus stage, and even before that, during the so-called invisible primary, where we are right now. When voters are sizing up the candidates and candidates are trying to distinguish themselves from each other. But once you get to the general election phase, there's actually not a lot of that.
If the real challenge then, Seth Masket, is for the candidate considered to be extreme to get his or her party's nomination, so then what is it going to take for a Ted Cruz to get him there?
Well, the thing is with someone like Cruz, it's not so much that he's very conservative. That's a hurdle for him, is that he's really defined his fairly brief career in national office by kind of making other important Republicans angry with him, convincing other Republicans to go along with a budget shutdown that was widely seen as a loss and a PR nightmare for his party, trying to convince people of the evils of Obamacare, and basically doing things that were largely seen as unhelpful forms of grandstanding. And that has helped increase his name recognition. When he campaigns, he can get an audience. There's, you know, conservative activists who have some idea who he is. But if you actually want to win the nomination, it helps to have party insiders on your side. In fact, it's almost impossible to get the nomination without that. And they're largely angry at him. So this is not necessarily the best way to pursue that path.
Seth Masket, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Denver, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Seth also writes the What Makes Us Politic column for Pacific Standard Magazine. And there's a link to read his recent column, Yes, Extremists Can Get Elected President. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. coming up from the political edges to the belly of the beast when Word of Mouth continues a conversation about how weight plays a role in presidential elections. From Bill Clinton to Chris Christie. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In a recent report, CNN rounded up the top Google searches on potential presidential candidates for 2016. And if the results are any indication, it seems people are more interested in a candidate's height and age than his or her political track record. For example, in March alone, the most searched question for Hillary Clinton was, how old is Hillary Clinton? For Jeb Bush, it was, how tall is Jeb Bush? Followed by, how old is he? For Chris Christie, however, the number two most searched question was a bit more pointed. How much does Chris Christie weigh? Followed by, how much weight has Governor Christie lost? Fashion director and chief fashion critic at the New York Times, Vanessa Friedman, tackles the weightier side of political candidacy in her New York Times article, For Male Politicians, Dieting is a Campaign Issue. And Vanessa Friedman, thrilled to have you on Word of Mouth.
Thanks very much.
So is weight a legitimate concern for candidates?
I think it's a tool. Certainly, if you look at how male politicians, not only in the U.S., but in the U.K. and in France, have used the kind of weight conversation, you know, it has been used to, you know, as a way to personalize them, to make them more accessible, and also to, you know, tell a success story about them.
You mean if they're not perfectly cut, that they are like you, they can't resist that second bowl of
ice cream? Exactly. And if, you know, on the sort of scale of what is a human weakness, you know, wanting some chocolate is actually not so bad.
Well, especially if you're French, I suppose. But do Americans in particular have a weight bias? Remember all of that kerfuffle about, you know, Paul Ryan's workout routine? People were really intrigued by that.
I mean, I think there's always been an interest in men's, you know, in fitness, particularly among male politicians, because it's a way of showing, you know, it's a way of being macho and being a he-man and showing that you're a guy. And that has also been used as a political tool, you know, with Paul Ryan, but also, you know, many others, whether it's, you know, Vladimir Putin on a hunting trip or, you know, President Obama playing basketball. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think actually that's a separate issue from the diet issue. It's a similar way to personalize, you know, someone who can seem plastic, far away, elitist, you know, too wonky. Any of the other things that are sometimes used as negatives with politicians, but is a different thing.
All right. But when is that imperfection too fat? I mean, when did weight become part of the conversation for male political candidates? Is it just Christie?
No, I think it's gone back before then. Certainly, you know, Bill Clinton and his bubbiness was part of the discussion. You know, his appetites for food and other things, you know, were seen as part of his signature, good or bad. You know, and again, like, you know, chowing down in the diner, in the barbecue joint, what have you, you know, was a way for people to relate to him.
These are powerful men. I mean, how one looks or how much they weigh is more often associated with female celebrities, for example. Is politics one of the few equal opportunity weight shaming arenas?
Actually, I think women politicians almost never discuss their weight. And in fact, it's the one thing that is never thrown at them. You know, I think with Hillary Clinton, you know, who's someone who's talked a lot about her issues with how her appearance is covered, you know, and has been sort of a lightning rod for that discussion. You know, you hear about the hair, endlessly about the hair. People talk about her clothes, you know, and I'm
certainly the pantsuits.
Yeah, you know, I'm as culpable as anyone in this because I think, you know, image and how people look is a communications tool and it is used by the smartest among us. And in fact, people who don't think about it that way are missing a trick. But you don't hear people talking about her weight. And it's the same thing with Angela Merkel. You know, it's the one kind of no-go area when it comes to female appearance in politics.
Well, not the least of which, they're not overweight, are they?
No, I mean, they look fine to me. you know, but arguably neither was Francois Hollande particularly overweight, and he was crowing about losing 15 kilograms, so.
Well, so for Chris Christie, his weight has been a little, well, it's made him, let's say, the butt of late night jokes. Mm-hmm. How can he use it to his advantage?
You know, I think whenever there's a question of appearance, whenever someone who is a public figure feels as though a discussion of their appearance is overwhelming a discussion perhaps of their, you know, political platforms or their position papers, which is what they'd rather be talking about, the way to diffuse it is to actually own it. You know, make a joke about it. Let people ask you a question and then sort of say, well, yeah, you know, do you really care? And move on.
Hmm.
As soon as you start getting upset about it, defensive about it, you know, refusing to talk about it, you imbue it with the power to hurt you, which then gets very interesting for other people.
All right. I can't resist asking you, what should Hillary Clinton be wearing, by the way?
I think whatever she feels comfortable in is probably right for her.
Vanessa Friedman, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Vanessa Friedman, she's fashion director and chief fashion critic at the New York Times. That's where we found her article for Male Politicians, Dieting is a Campaign Issue. We have a link to read it for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. As Hillary Clinton begins her bid to become the first female president of the United States, we look back to 1940 when a very different candidate took the stage. Gracie Allen, half of the popular comic duo Burns and Allen, launched a presidential campaign that began as a publicity stunt. But during a whistle-stop tour across the country, the campaign took on a life of its own. This story comes to us from Radio Diaries.
George Burns and Gracie Allen.
My name is Cynthia Clements. I'm co-author of George Burns and Gracie Allen, a biobibliography.
My name is Robert Easton, and I had the great privilege of working with George and Gracie on the show. In the 1930s and the 1940s, the Burns and Allen show was one of the most popular shows on radio.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much.
Hello.
What are you laughing at?
Oh, at that sales girl at Bullock's Motel.
Gracie Allen was a small woman, barely 5 feet tall. She had this very high-pitched voice, and she was seen as being dizzy.
People loved Gracie. All over the country, the American people just adored her. So no matter how outrageous the things that she said were, she got away with it.
Hello, Gracie. Coming down to the studio tonight, I saw a big...
February 7th, 1940... During the Burns and Allen broadcast, Gracie says that she was thinking about running for president. And this would begin one of the most famous publicity stunts ever created for radio.
George, I'll let you in on a secret. I'm running for president.
You're running for president?
Yes.
Gracie, how long has this been going on?
Well, for 150 years. George Washington started it.
But in the entire history of the United States, there's never been a woman president.
Well, yeah, isn't that exciting? I'll be the first one.
Vote for Gracie.
Oh, great, you love to meet you.
Vote for Gracie.
On the island of Capri.
She's the best little skipper in the land. Vote for Gracie.
When they first initiated the idea of having Gracie run for the presidency, the whole thing was just a publicity stunt. You have to understand there was a depression, there was world war that was looming on the horizon. I think it brought a much-needed sense of comedy relief to very tense times.
Miss Allen, my newspaper wants to know just what your platform is.
Oh, yes, I was working on it last night, and I'll read what I've written. Unemployment and where to get it. Under my administration, the government will give free correspondence courses so that people who can't find jobs in their own line will soon be without jobs in 3 or 4 different types of work.
Miss Allen, what do you think of our national debt?
Well, we ought to be proud of it. It's the biggest in the world.
Vote for Gracie.
She has a platform, cabinet members, billboards, campaign buttons. Students at Harvard nominated her for president. There was a small town somewhere that wanted to name her mayor.
And it took off much more than they could have imagined.
Vote for Gracie. Keep voting all day long.
She took the train from L.A. to Omaha, making all these stump speeches from the back of the train.
And people actually would go to see her. It's estimated maybe 100,000 people.
Hello.
Well, I want to tell our listeners that we're here in Omaha, Nebraska for Gracie's convention.
Burns and Allen broadcast the convention for Gracie Allen on May the 15th, 1940.
I hereby nominate for President of the United States, Gracie Allen.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for nominating me your candidate for president. Some people say to me, don't count your chickens before they're hatched, Gracie. You haven't been elected yet. Of course, there is a remote possibility of that. But should such a thing happen, I'll say what Mr. Dion said to the nurse when she told him that he was the father of quintuplets. I demand a recount.
The actual convention itself was very successful, but maybe it had run its course. And not too long after the convention, she says, I'm going to stop my campaign now. And she gave sort of a serious speech. She says the way the world was today, that she was stepping back and letting the serious campaigning go ahead.
Even after she had retired her candidacy, in the actual election, with heavyweights like Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Wilkie and a number of other people from minor parties running, she actually got thousands of write-in votes. We tend to take politics so deadly serious, but looking back on it in 1940, the country needed something like this.
Well, Gracie, say goodnight.
Well, goodnight. I'll see you in the White House.
Say goodnight.
Vote for Gracie to win the presidential race. 100 million strong. That's right, you can't go wrong. Vote for Gracie. Keep voting
always. 150 years ago today, President Abraham Lincoln was shot at Ford's Theater, an event now universally considered to be tragic. But at the time, the country's reaction was anything but unified. That story when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In April of 1865, less than a week after General Robert E. Lee surrendered the Confederacy, a nation beleaguered by a four-year war was reeling once again. President Abraham Lincoln had been assassinated. As word of the president's death spread, the public mourned his loss, mostly. The United States had been divided by a contentious civil war, one that pitted brother against brother. And while many citizens lamented the loss of their leader, others cheered, and not only in the South. Martha Hodes is professor of history at New York University and author of the new book, Mourning Lincoln, which delves into the aftermath of the tragedy 150 years ago this month. Martha, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much.
So what was the state of the Union when Lincoln was shot on April the 14th, Good Friday, we should add, 1865?
Well, the war had just ended, the Confederacy had just surrendered, and all sides were relieved in many ways. Union supporters were jubilant, Confederates were in complete despair, and then on top of both of those feelings and emotions came the assassination, the nation's first presidential assassination.
How did people find out about the shooting and death of Lincoln?
Well, the Telegraph, wherever the Telegraph ran, the newspaper journalists would go to the Telegraph offices, get the telegrams, and print the headlines. So the Telegraph and newspapers spread the word as early as that day. But what's really fascinating is, as the newspaper boys ran through the streets, the first people to get the news were laborers who were up early in the morning cooking for their masters, building fires, the milkman delivering the milk. And so the working classes got the news first and often delivered it to their masters.
Hmm. Do people believe it? Do they have to somehow verify it?
Oh, people didn't believe it. It was literally incredible, literally unbelievable. People wrote in their diaries and in letters that they were stupefied, astounded. People invoked the metaphor of a thunderbolt from a clear blue sky. A former slave said she felt an electric shock to my soul. It was simply too horrible and too terrible to believe. Mm. People said it was like a play on a stage. So today we would say, I felt like I was in a movie.
Was there any, you know, we didn't have photographs then. There were no newspapers or videos, certainly shouted about the internet. Did they need proof somehow that it actually happened?
Yeah. Yes, that's such a good question, because now, of course, we think we would turn to our televisions, we turn to our cell phones, and we turn to social media. What people did in 1865 was they turned to the human face, so not Facebook, but human faces. So they immediately, when they saw the newspaper headlines, they ran outside. The first thing to do was to look into other people's faces. If other people's faces were stricken, if tears were rolling down their cheeks, men and women, then they knew they weren't dreaming. They weren't in a play on a stage. And that was a major means of verification.
This was, as you mentioned, the first presidential assassination with no precedent for what should happen in these kind of cases of national emergency or tragedy. What did people do? I mean, did businesses close? Were flags flown at half-mast? Did people stay home from work?
Absolutely. So business seemed to stop, although the only stores that remained open were stores that sold black goods that were for mourning drapery. People would write in their diaries things like, instantly the entire village or city was draped in black. Well, of course it wasn't instant. It was through the labor of various people. So women and workers were up on ladders and hammering black cloth and mourning bunting onto all of the facades. Businesses did close that morning, except, of course, if you sold black goods, and then you took in hundreds of thousands of dollars because everybody wanted to trim their flags with black and put black on their armbands and wear black badges. And so that was another way of proving what had happened, that the landscape was transformed.
But not everybody was grieving. I mean, we think of him today as the iconic president who changed the fate of the nation. Obviously, things were a little more complicated back then.
Yes, that's right. What's so interesting is that Lincoln's mourners write in their journals and letters that everyone, everywhere, all across the nation, even the world, was grieving. But they knew that wasn't true. So first of all, they knew that Confederates weren't grieving. Confederates had mixed feelings about Lincoln, but in many ways they despised him. And so Confederates rejoiced not only in private, but also in public. They thanked God, they cheered, they laughed, they clapped, they taunted African Americans. But the other thing is that there were Northerners, there were white Northerners who despised Lincoln too. These were the Copperheads, his political opponents. And they really confounded this idea of universal grief by laughing and cheering and waving their caps and displaying a kind of joviality that infuriated the mourners.
Was there any kind of punishment for this kind of disrespect?
Yes, there was. In fact, mourners were absolutely infuriated by people who displayed any sort of glee. And so this is both Lincoln's mourners in the North and Union occupiers in the South. So, for example, Union soldiers who were in front of Confederates. So they reacted violently with words and with actions. And Union soldiers who maligned the president, because not all Union soldiers loved Lincoln, were often brought up on charges of treason as an accessory after the fact of the crime. So we have a soldier from Maine who simply said in front of his comrades, "This is too good to believe." We have a soldier from New York who said, "Hip, hip, hurrah, Lincoln is dead." And all of those kinds of words and actions are recorded in these court proceedings.
Wow. Well, how about the mourners? I mean, I think of the 19th century as this time when people were reserved and stoic when it came to emotion. Did they show their grief publicly?
What's so interesting is that the rules of decorum in the 19th century were just as you said, and especially for men. You just weren't supposed to be particularly emotional, especially in public. Well, at this moment of the assassination, all the rules of decorum are just out the window. And especially, people write over and over again in their letters and diaries that men were weeping. Hmm. People write about ministers breaking down. There's an example of a person writes in a diary, "The minister broke down and the tears rolled down his cheeks." There's another example of the minister could only get through the sermon with a violent effort of self-control. That was the phrase this woman used. And men are walking down the streets weeping, wiping their eyes, looking into one another's faces. Women are noticing their husbands crying and writing down that this is the first time they've seen men cry. And people are not ashamed of this. It is such an enormous catastrophe for Lincoln's mourners.
I'm speaking with Martha Hodes about her new book, Mourning Lincoln, which takes a personal look into the lives of ordinary citizens in the aftermath of the assassination of President Lincoln 150 years ago. You also write a lot in the book about the far less recorded population, those of the African American, the slaves, and also those who were free African Americans, their reaction to Lincoln's death. First of all, how did you find these accounts?
Well, it was much more difficult to find written accounts of African Americans. Now, there are African-Americans who did, certainly African-American soldiers who were literate and wrote letters, and there were some African-Americans who kept diaries that have been preserved. But largely, I read African-American newspapers in which, for example, soldiers would write letters to the newspapers. And I also read the writings of whites who worked with African-Americans. So, for example, Northern missionaries who worked with African-Americans during the war down south. And say a teacher was teaching a class and somebody would come in and give the news of the assassination. And then the teacher would write a report back to the Missionary Association recording what people did. So, for example, a young child who said, does this mean we have to be slaves again now that Lincoln is no longer alive? And we have just bereft Union soldiers, the black men. Also, fear was a response on the part of African Americans. Fear about emancipation, fear about equality, fear about citizenship that they thought might not come to pass now. And of course, free African Americans in the North, they wrote about feeling stricken down and hopeless. And Frederick Douglass called it an unspeakable calamity, the assassination.
I'm thinking about times of national tragedy that we can remember. You know, September 11th comes to mind, and you actually write about that a bit in your book. Despite all of the sort of differences between people, between populations, this was a time of unification after September 11th. You know, the country was sort of defiant. How about then? We had a country that had been divided for so long. Did this national tragedy create a kind of balm for those ills or further drive a wedge in between the sides?
Well, what's interesting about 9/11 is that when I was writing this book, I thought back and I remembered it just as you said. I remembered it as a time of national unity. But in fact, when I looked back at the photographs I'd taken in the streets of New York on September 12th, the next morning, I saw all kinds of arguments going on. Some people wanted revenge. Some people wanted peace. Some people didn't want to trust the media. So the signs that I took pictures of made clear this kind of contention. And the same kind of tension and contention was absolutely true in 1865. Mourners might have felt unified, but they were at tremendous odds with Lincoln's enemies and still at tremendous odds with Confederates. There was still a war going on off the battlefield, even though Robert E. Lee had surrendered to Ulysses S. Grant.
The war, of course, claimed the lives of more than 750,000. If you think about the size of the population, that is so significant. And you mentioned in the book that meant nearly everybody knew someone who died in the Civil War. How did that affect how mourners responded to the death of Abraham Lincoln?
Very important. So that figure that you gave is about 2% of the population at the time, which translates into almost what would be today, 7 million lives lost. So as you said, everybody knew somebody. Lincoln's death in some ways seemed like the ultimate death or the last casualty of the Civil War, but it wasn't literally so because men kept dying in Union hospitals and at home and in camp. But Lincoln's funeral and the mourning for Lincoln gave people a chance to publicly express what had just become a parade of one local funeral after another, because his death was such an enormous event that it gave them a moment to express that grief for their own loved ones in a public setting.
How long did this mourning of Lincoln publicly continue?
Well, Lincoln's body was taken on a two-week, 1,700-mile journey after the funeral in Washington, which took place on April 19th, and he was buried. The train took him to his hometown of Springfield, Illinois, where he was buried on May 4th. So all of this went on for 2 weeks, and many of the mourners followed every report about the funeral train, and there were funerals in 11 major cities along the way, and the train passed through many, many towns and villages where people would come to look at it. Then after the funeral was over, people still left up their bunting. They often left it up for weeks after that. Soldiers on their way home from the war would pass through towns and write in their diaries that the mourning bunting was still up from the funeral. People took a long time to give it away, to take it down, so it lingered for quite some time.
Martha Hodes, I want to thank you for joining us. A fascinating topic.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
Martha Hodes, professor of history at NYU and author of the new book, Mourning Lincoln. We do have a link to more information on the book. It's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. We've been talking a lot about the executive branch today. Well, when we come back, we'll get a deeper look at the legislative branch, clandestine marble bathtubs, and more secrets from beneath the Capitol building when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Take a trip to the nation's capital, and you have several options to visit government buildings. You can take a public tour of the White House, or a self-guided stroll through the Supreme Court, or arrange for a guided tour at the Capitol building, where you'll pass by the Crypt, Rotunda, and National Statuary Hall. That's the standard tour, anyway. If you want to find out what lies beyond the closed doors in the depths of the Capitol, it helps to have a curious reporter to show you the way. Roman Mars from the podcast 99% Invisible found that reporter.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars.
I have this habit of walking into any door that's unlocked. And it actually does me well here in the Capitol because you start poking around and going into doors and you find the coolest things.
You have to appreciate the moxie of someone who can wander around a federal building, open up a random door, and announce to whoever's on the other side.
Hello. Hi, I'm Andrea Seabrook with NPR.
If you didn't catch that, that's NPR congressional correspondent Andrea Seabrook.
I'm a reporter. We're poking around looking at secret things in the Capitol.
I am so in love with Andrea Seabrook right now.
The woman on the other side of the door tells Andrea that she needs to leave and that walking into random doors in the basement of the U.S. Capitol building is not what she's supposed to be doing.
And that's 99% Invisible's own Sam Greenspan. He went with Andrea to the Capitol building. I'm so jealous of him right now.
That's not what we're supposed to be doing.
But that doesn't deter you, though.
No. Are you kidding? I don't care what they think I'm supposed to be doing. I'm here to cover the United States Capitol. And frankly, I see this as part of it.
Even if you try to set aside its role as the hub of Western democracy, the Capitol building itself, just the building, is an overwhelming structure.
There are 6,000 people who work in this complex. That's including the staffers, though, not including the politicians. I mean, it's a huge city, and it has one function, if you can call it a function, and that is running the legislative branch, the government, both, you know, writing the bills and cleaning the toilets.
As if we could tell the difference. Am I right?
The Capitol is known for its grandeur, the Rotunda, Statuary Hall,
the Crypt, the marble staircases.
This place is unbelievably ornamental. The walls upstairs have gorgeous friezes, you know, with birds and squirrels and gorgeous, gorgeous, lilting, beautiful paintwork.
And that's all the stuff we're supposed to see. But when you're an inveterate doorknob turner and snoop like Andrea Seabrook, you also get to know the Capitol below the surface.
Literally, the basement.
Down here, there's a whole bunch of engineers, you know, like HVAC engineers in blue uniforms that say, like, you know, Joe on them.
The purpose of the building, the business of government, trickles down to these lower levels.
The members of the House, the Republican caucus, and sometimes the Democrats, meet in the basement for their sort of closed-door secret strategy sessions. And it's a really good place to get kind of a tip from members that you know about what's going on.
But the main reason we're here is to see a little bit of the architectural grandeur that has trickled down here, too.
Oh, it says, please check in with the engineers, which I think I'll do. Just get on with it, man. One thing that's cool is, I'll just show it to you.
Andrea is leading me through the serpentine route of alleys and doorways and...
Really in the, oh my gosh, here we are.
I know, it's amazing.
And then there are these bathtubs.
It's amazing. There are these beautiful marble bathtubs with marble steps that lead up to them and brass fittings, and they're deep, beautiful bathtubs. Just to describe it a little bit, it's sort of a white ivory marble that has this luster. It reminds me of the Venus de Milo or something. It shines, it glows a little bit, and it's got very faint black veins in it. And it's just gorgeous. The curves in it are so gentle and continuous.
But for all the grandeur the tubs possess, the room itself is the exact opposite. This place was supposed to cool off senators. Now it cools and heats the entire Capitol building.
There's big HVAC equipment and computer servers and large steel cabinets containing God knows what.
Even though the bathtubs along with the sink and toilet were here first, they're the ones that seem out of place.
The bathtubs were installed around 1860 during the expansion of the Capitol. D.C. is known for its swampy summers, and legend has it that senators could be banished from the chamber if they were too smelly.
It still reeks, but yeah, back then it was less figurative.
And most people at the time, even politicians, they didn't have indoor plumbing at home, so Congress needed a place where the politicians could go and wash up.
Andrea reads from an informational card beside the tub.
Okay, here we go. Each bathtub, and I am standing in one right now, was carved in Italy from a single block of Carrara marble. Three bathtubs were shipped from Genoa, Italy in July 1859 and reached Baltimore in November of that year. July to November. The other three were shipped from Leghorn, Italy in September of 1859 and arrived in New York in January of 1860. The precise dates of the bathtub's arrival and installation at the Capitol are uncertain, but the Senate bathing room is known to have been in operation as of February 23, 1860.
Each of the six tubs cost $90 in 1860, which is around $2,500 a piece today. And that was just to buy the tubs. You gotta figure it was still more to ship them from Italy, receive them at the port of Baltimore, transport them to Capitol Hill, and then you had to build a bathing facility suitable to a senator. They had oakwood paneling,
plaster cornices,
Minton tile,
egg and dart molding.
Of the six original tubs, only two are left, and one has a piece of plywood over it that props up some padlocked steel mystery box. The other was decommissioned years ago.
This place is a total collision of eras, not just old versus new, and I know that just a little bit ago, we were considering the Capitol building as just a building. It's impossible to look at this room and not see a metaphorical debate right here in the basement.
We are having this great debate in our country, whether you're in the Tea Party or the Occupy movement, both share the same concern about who the government is for. And I think the politicians have tried really hard to make it look as if the government is for the people and not for the gorgeously appointed bathers of the world. For example, when Newt Gingrich took over the House speakership in 1995 after, you know, a giant sweep of the 94 elections, he found that there were buckets of ice still being delivered to every single member of Congress's office, even though they all had refrigerators with ice makers. It was back from the time when you had to buy ice separately, and so they sort of shut down all that stuff. At the same time, they got rid of the House historian. They defunded all of these things they thought of as luxuries, and they got rid of a lot of the funding for saving things like this.
As Andrea puts it, the spending versus austerity question is really just the modern form of the quintessential American question of government.
Which is, how much government should exist? What is it there to do? And at one point, about 140 some odd years ago, there was this idea of the government being an important institution, one that would have gorgeously appointed baths. And now we're sitting in a boiler room and the beautiful Minton tile has been painted over with industrial gray paint and the walls are kind of dirty and it's loud and there's no way to pay homage to it anymore. It's tucked in a corner and dirty and there's a roach trap on the floor. Gorgeous. See how the marble kind of sparkles a little bit? If it's a little bit clean, look closer here. You see this sort of luster?
I don't think there's any modern political persuasion that would advocate for the installation of luxurious $3,000 marble bathtubs for senators. As lovely as they may be, the bathtubs, not the senators. But if the ornate marble bathtubs are already there, they were installed 150 years ago, what do you do with them? What represents the people now?
I mean, it's interesting that it's still preserved, but it's likely not going to be restored.
No. Not unless we had some resurgence in respect for our government. Can you imagine the people wanting to pay? Even if it was only, I don't know, give it $500,000 just to be crazy, just to restore this area. It may be a lot more than that, actually, come to think of how much you'd have to move. But I don't know. You want to go open some doors?
Yes.
And that story was produced by Sam Greenspan and Roman Mars for the podcast 99% Invisible. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There's so much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like it, please tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please come back tomorrow, too, for more Word of Mouth right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
With help from our intern,
Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.